Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 20th of November 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com for the first time in quite a few weeks, because normally we would have Dennis Wise with us, my co-host. Dennis is currently receiving treatment for various conditions, so he is unable to be here, and we have struggled to find guests of Dennis's calibre, but I do think we have one today, and I'm very grateful for the other guests that we've had talking about slavery, and also Thomas Goodrich. And today we have another very, very interesting guest. Our listeners will probably be aware, myself and Dennis have covered interviews with Gudrun Himmler, and I think Goering's daughter as well. And the man that actually carried out these interviews and about 200 others is with us today. I'm just going to refer to him as Arne Nerb, which is the name that he uses in the chat room. And he's currently putting all these interviews together for a book. So he's here today to talk about how he came to be making these interviews and the sort of impression that he got from them. So I'm very pleased to say welcome to the show, Arne Nerb. And how are you doing today?
Doing good, Sven. Thanks for having me.
Excellent, excellent. So how did you come to be making interviews with people that fought in the war and their daughters and their relations? How did that all come about? Was it in Germany? I guess it must have been.
It was, but it starts here in the United States, actually. My family was on my grandparent, or my mother's side, pretty large, and my grandfather had lots of brothers and relatives, and my grandfather fought in the war, actually against Germany, and had, you know, several relatives that did as well. When I was really young, this had to be, I think, in 1979, I believe, one of his cousins or brothers or somebody had lived in Germany, had stayed in Germany after the war because he met a German girl, got married. They came and visited. And I remember I was just so kind of taken aback that, you know, as a foreign person in our home, and that she was a German. And I had started to develop an interest in German history because my grandfather brought back, you know, the typical helmet and dagger, the medals and things. And I liked to play with them and just had an interest. I wanted to know what she was like, you know, what her thoughts were. And I just remember kind of a very childish way, because I think I was only maybe 10 or 11 years old at the time, trying to carry on conversations with her. And I was just really impressed with how she explained things to me, that she had been in the League of German Girls and then had trained to be a nurse at one of the hospitals in Nuremberg. She had a very fascinating story. You know, she started off in the BDM on a rowing team, which is how she met Gudrun Himmler, Berwitz. I can get into that later. But they, long story short, after talking to her, she made an offer for my mom to have me come and live with them in Germany for a summer coming up. And this was, I think, in 1983. So it had been a few years past, and I had stayed in contact with them, writing them letters and things. So I was able to go live with them. I think I had left, got out of school a little early. It was from May of 1983 all the way till the beginning of September of 1983. And one of the very first things when we made it to their apartment or their flat in Nuremberg, she had told me that there were a lot of veterans that lived in the building with them. And one of the first people that I met was a man who was in the Leibstandarte. And he was just fascinating to talk to. I think by now I was, 13 years old. And it was just fascinating to be able to talk, you know, to someone who actually was in the war. He even told a funny story about he had contracted dysentery during the relief effort on Budapest, and he was in an outhouse doing his business when Russian soldiers attacked and just started shooting everywhere while he's in the outhouse, that he ran out with his pants down. And yeah, this is kind of a funny story to visualize, but was able to go run and grab his weapons and ended up kind of doing a fighting with a retreat with his platoon. So that's kind of how it started. She introduced me to him, and I said, oh, this is really fascinating. Is there more that I can meet? And so she started introducing me to more and more in the building, and it grew from there.
That must have been really fascinating. Just at the age of 13, I mean, you're going into a new country, and you meet somebody who's fought in the war and fought on the other side, and he tells you this interesting, funny story. And I should imagine you're starting to think then, well, this is something that I haven't heard of before. I haven't heard the German side of the story. Did you know that she knew Gudrun Himmler at the time? I mean, you knew she was obviously part of the German ladies' union, but were you aware of the connections that she had at the time?
No, not at all. Not until I went and lived with them. When I went and lived with them, she really opened up. She showed me, she had a beautiful photo album, and it had probably 500 very high quality photos that she took because she liked photography. And you know, one of the things that Dr. Goebbels had really promoted to the German people, and I believe I can't quote it exactly, but he said something like, we live in very unique times for this nation, and I would like everybody to document these times. And they made cameras and film very affordable for even the poorest German. And so that's why there's out on the collector's market, there's just millions and millions of photos, because every German was encouraged to go get a portrait photo done, commemorate the memories you're living through, take, you know, pictures of everything you're doing. She was one of those people. She had photos of her. She was a rower on the Nuremberg. They called themselves the Nuremberg Girls, I think, if I remember her translation correctly. And they were a pretty good rowing team. And she had told me, you know, how she met Gudrun. They were on Tegernsee at some type of a BDM rowing meet, and they had pulled their boats up onto the shore by the dock, and they were all relaxing and eating after one of the competitions. I guess Margot and Gudrun had walked by, and Gudrun had kind of broken away because I think then she was very young, and she broke away and ran up to one of the boats, and it just happened to be my aunt was by the boat, and she had said, "You know, can I sit in the boat and see it?" And so my aunt kind of lifted, put her in the boat, and Margot was talking to the leader and saw her getting into the boat and ran over and was like, oh, no, she can't get in the boat. Get her out. And so my aunt got her out of the boat, and then she offered her an apple to eat. And so that just sparked a friendship. You know, Margot, which is Himmler's wife, then had invited them up to where they live for, I think, lemonade or, you know, drink and some snacks. And my aunt got, you know, the address and asked to write Gudrun because they had really started talking. So that was the start of their friendship.
Wow. So and obviously they'd stayed friends all the way up to the 70s when you were there.
They had broken off. I don't know the full story. I was so young back then that it didn't really dawn on me to dig that. Today I would, you know, this is something I would dig into and drill down as far as I could get. But just from what I understand, my aunt and they both went to college after the war, and they stayed very close because, you know, they basically were living in uncertain times. You know, they had lost the war. You know, of course, Gudrun had lost her father. My aunt had lost her mother, who was killed in one of the bombing raids on Nuremberg. And then her father was conscripted to serve on the Eastern Front. And he was never, you know, he wrote one last letter home. I think it was in 44 during Operation Bagration, when the Soviets launched the offensive to coincide with the Normandy invasion, and he was posted as missing. Years later, I guess she had heard that he had been taken prisoner and then shot or killed by the Soviets. So, you know, she was, you know, kind of depressed and forlorn. That's one of the reasons she ended up with my, I'll just say he's my great uncle. I don't know what he would be called, but that's why she ended up with him, because she was by herself in Nuremberg, and he was one of the few that had kind of reached out to her without wanting sex. And, you know, because that's one of the MOs that she always said that the American occupation forces in Nuremberg, Munich, and all that always would, you know, I'll give you a sea ration if you take me behind the barn, basically. And she said my uncle was he was not like that, which was fortunate. So they ended up together.
And when did you get the idea then of interviewing some of these people and trying to get their stories from them? Because you must have been a lot older than 13 at the time when you were doing that, I would have thought.
Well, yeah, I was stationed in Germany in the service in the late 1980s. And so by then I had matured a lot. I had made a lot of connections with just the people that Gudrun had been able to put me in touch with. Like, what I kind of branched out into was wanting to meet the combat soldier. So I was able to attend a lot of the reunions for Waffen-SS veterans, you know, for either the Panzer Corps veterans, the Hague veterans, whatever organization they went to, I was invited to always attend. And I was able to meet quite a few Waffen-SS Knights Cross holders, you know, like Ernst Krog, you know, was one of them that I've done an interview with. And they're just, you know, looking at the list, there's just tons of them.
And what was the sort of general idea that you got from them? Were they all sort of in unison on some points that they all agreed on? What was the general impression that you got from these SS generals and leaders in the SS?
They all were in unison. That is one thing that – so one of the things that kind of kept me going with this, I hate to even use his name because he's so – you know, vile, but the Holocaust guy, Eli Wiesel, however you pronounce his name, he wrote an article or commented on an article one time, and it was about something like why we don't forgive the Germans. And he, in the article, said the Germans are liars. They're not telling us the truth. They won't, you know, admit that they knew, you know, that the camps existed, that the Holocaust happened and all that. And that kind of took me, because when I was going to school, one of the themes that was hammered home at us was that the Germans are ashamed of Hitler and what they did during the Third Reich. And I already had kind of formed my view that, no, they're not there. Because I had also, in addition to my aunt, I guess I should also say, I lived in an area in Columbus, Ohio called German Village, and we had a lot of Germans that had immigrated after the war. So I was able to talk to some of them as growing up, too. We had, matter of fact, a gentleman lived next door to us that was on the battleship Gneisenau, and I used to always go over and I would talk to him and his wife. I'd always look at his medals that he brought back, and yeah, I would collect stuff and take it over and show him. And one of the recurring themes was that we didn't do these things that it said that we did. You know, we definitely, you know, we knew that Jews were being put in concentration camps, but only the bad ones, because they would always say there were plenty of Jews running around Germany that were not, you know, bothered and all that. And the more I heard that, I was like, well, why? Are when you see these interviews on, like, the, you know, the History Channel or National Geographic, they're showing the Germans that say things like, oh yeah, we knew Hitler had to go, he was horrible, you know, life was miserable under the Third Reich, and oh, I can't believe what we did to the Jews, it was horrible, we knew nothing about it, we knew nothing what was happening. And I just started to think, but that's not what I'm being told by other people that I talked to. They said they absolutely knew Jews were going to camps because they were thought to be an enemy of the German people, especially after 1938 when Ernst Roth was assassinated by, I forget the Jewish kid's name. He was a militant communist. But it was just interesting that, you know, they viewed the Jews as a foreign people that they were at war with, much like what we did with the Japanese on the West Coast, which it's kind of funny. And for America, the view that Americans have is we took an enemy people that attacked us and we put them in camps to watch them, which is okay. But when the Germans did the same thing, it's not. It's horrible. And it led to a Holocaust and exterminations and things, which is just completely untrue. That's, to me, it was always kind of a hypocritical, you know, way that history kind of looks at things.
Well, it is totally hypocritical, and we're not taught to look at it that way. We're taught to look as if these Jews were, oh, they were just following the Jewish religion, and they were really Germans, as if it was the Germans persecuting their own people for some very strange reason. And we're told they just did it because they were Jews. We're not told that the leaders of world Jewry had actually declared war on Germany years before the war broke out. We aren't told about the embargo, the trade embargo that they put on Germany. We're not told about the percentage of Jews that were involved in communism. We're not told, as you just pointed out there, about this assassination, and the guy was Jewish, and it was a communist as well as Jewish. And these Jews that were actually put in camps, they were put in camps because they were communists and because they were a danger to the state. And also, as you pointed out, there were plenty of Jews that were running around that weren't in the camps because they weren't deemed to be a danger in any way. I've been looking through some of these interviews today, and that comes across quite clearly that they didn't want to be treating the Jews in any way that would cause the Jews to be able to complain about it. They wanted it all to be above board. They wanted them to be treated well in the camps. I seem to remember in one of your interviews, I think it is Gudrun Himmler, she talks about going into the camps and being allowed into the camps to see what was going on, and this idea that Jews were being mistreated in there. It just couldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened. And it's a big propaganda coup that they've managed to get people to think differently today. So you were starting to be aware of what you were being told in school, and the general narrative was not what you were being told by these Germans. Did you know by then that the Germans that you were talking to, I mean, they were more National Socialist Germans rather than sort of modern Germans? For somehow they'd managed to not get taken in by the denazification. Did you realize that you know, you were starting to be connected to people that were connected to some quite high up National Socialists at all? When did you work that out?
Well, it would have been when I stayed for that first summer, because my aunt, you know, one of the things, she sat me down and she said, you know, you're going to be talking to some people that you may not understand where they're coming from. And I want to tell you that they know me very well. I have worked with them because my aunt actually had, you know, she said her and Gudrun Himmler, a lot of other of the women of these men, they were part of a group called Silent Help, which gave financial aid to a lot of the Waffen-SS men that had basically been released from prison for, you know, the made up war crimes trials and things like that. So they formed the group to help them. And that is what I think opened up a lot of the contacts for me, because these were people that they never lost faith, is one of the things I could definitely tell. And because they trusted her and she was bringing me into that circle, they in turn trusted me, and they would say things to me that they knew would get them in a lot of trouble if it would be spoken to anybody else. Like, they would openly talk about the Holocaust. You know, one of the things I'm very glad that I was able to kind of see that a lot of historians are denied. I've spoken to people that worked for the Gestapo, for the Sicherheitspolizei, they even worked in Heydrich's office under Heydrich. And I can tell you some of the stories that they told were extremely fascinating, like, that you never would think of you know, the way that history's presented us. Like, for example, as soon as the National Socialists were elected to power in Germany, one of the first things that they did, they started cracking down on Jewish landlords. And this is something that the early Gestapo got involved with, because what they were seeing happen, the Jews that had come into Germany from the East, they called them Eastern Jews, and they came on the invitation of Jewish friends and relatives that were already in Germany. So when they got to Germany, they gave them, you know, ownership in businesses. They gave them property that they had gotten after World War I. So these were landlords that were basically charging exuberant prices for properties that Germans were now living in. And if a German was late paying the rent, for example, the Jews were notorious, or I should say these Jewish landlords were notorious for just throwing them out on the street without, you know, you missed 5 days, I can't give you more, you're out. So what the National Socialists did to rectify the situation, they went back, and part of the Gestapo investigations are these, they returned a lot of these former, or they returned a lot of these buildings back to their former German owners and took them away from Jews. And then they charged the Jews with extortion. And for, I don't know what laws it was, but they just said they were charged with extortion. They were charged with a lot of like financial crimes. A lot of them fled, like Anne Frank's father, Leo, had been involved with some type of shyster banking fraud in Germany. And so he fled the country with his, you know, family and went in hiding in Holland when the when Germany invaded. But that's just one of many examples that I just heard, you know, things like that. I was like, wow, we have just been fed a completely made up bogus version of the history of the Third Reich, if that's what they went through. And this is just the tip of the iceberg.
So he was actually wanted for bank fraud then. He wasn't put in the camps because he was a Jew or anything
no.
like that.
There was actual no. crimes. In order to be put into a concentration camp, from, you know, what I have kind of researched and gathered, you had to fall under maybe a couple of different criteria. One would be an outright criminal. Like the National Socialists, they were, you know, in some ways they were a very open society, very free, in especially regarding, you know, sex, things like that. You know, you look at the artwork, the human body was something to be absolutely admired, if not worshipped. But on the other hand, the Jews, which a lot of your listeners probably already know, had a hand in a lot of the degenerate art. Just think of what we see today as our modern art masterpieces. Well, a lot of this was going on in Germany back then too. And I have always, like, one of the things that was impressioned on me from these people is art is a window into a person's soul. So you can just imagine that the type of art that we see today, what that person's mind is like. And the Germans had to deal with that. So there were a lot of the Jews back then that were, they were thrown in camps for being child molesters. There were some homosexuals that it was bizarre. I think if I remember correctly, seeing something good, Mr. Goodrich had done something about or mentioned something about Berlin being Babylon. And I thought that video or that film is spot on. Because with the people that I've spoken to that had served in the Gestapo, part of the things they had to contend with for the first few years of their creation was getting rid of all of the filth that was in Germany that the Jews had brought. I talked to one where he was a Gestapo person in Berlin and talked about that the Jews had imported a lot of the fetish type things. I think, like, some people might be aware of what, you know, people that go down to Mexico and the women and the donkeys and things. These are the types of things that Jews brought into Germany and National Socialism stamped out. And so they arrested all the lawbreakers, the ones that were the financial scammers that had been taking advantage of the people. Then they also went after the organized criminal element, which a lot of organized crime has had Jewish roots. They went after that, smashed it, through the leaders in prison. And if they were convicted of murder, well, then they were just taken out and executed. You know, National Socialism had no time to dally with, you know, people that were so evil. So they, a lot of them were executed outright for murder and things like that. The sexual perverts were put away, or they were forced to leave the nation. Some of them, if they'd had the means and, you know, the crime maybe couldn't be proven 100%, they were just, you know, told to get out. And then I think, you know, in regards to the first part of this, there were Jews who were considered unreliable. These are the ones that starting in like 1941 were forced to move and evacuate to the east, which I think was Himmler's initial plan. You know, I think his plan overall was Jews are not German. They're not European. They come from the east. They are not of European blood. And for them to pretend that they are is a sin against our people. And so, you know, in his mind, we're not going to have them here at all. But we also are going to be humane to them. So what we're going to do is we are going to make them, you know, go back to where they came and certainly not let any more come in. And so that was kind of the goal, where the ones that had been maybe suspected of not being completely loyal to Germany, these were the ones that were forced to go into the camps during the evacuations to the east later on.
So they were in there alongside the criminals and the degenerates. And I know that if they were quite big on rehabilitating people. I mean, that was the origin of the work Will Set You Free. And there were Germans that were badly behaved and needed help on their way. And that was also the idea of the camps was to rehabilitate people. If there were people that couldn't be rehabilitated, habitual criminals and as you were saying, they're murderers, then, you know, they had the death sentence for that. But if somebody had been caught for, say, homosexuality and they were young, they would then get reframing in the camps with the view to when they go out, then they would then lead a productive life, and they would be taught not to be profligate and not to be a rent boy or whatever, and they would try to put them straight. Well, this is all really sort of talking about the camps here, and you mentioned about talking to these SS generals. So what was it like talking to them? What was the sort of things that they were interested in talking about to you?
One of the things that had struck me and that I have always tried to ask everyone that I interviewed was the German war crimes claims. You know, because you can't turn on the TV without hearing something about, you know, war crimes that the Germans did back then. And when I had started asking their opinions, you know, did you witness anything that would concern you? The answer for all of them, you know, pretty much per man, was no. Especially the Waffen-SS, they were all volunteer soldiers, you know, for the most part, except at the very end of the war. And they had a very high code of conduct where they, you know, they treated prisoners very humanely. They would not tolerate any type of abuse. And when probed about war crimes, especially Malmedy, like I interviewed, I think it was Hans Siptrot, if anybody knows who he was a panzer commander who was right at the Malmedy crossroads when the reconnaissance unit of the Leibstandarte had attacked the American artillery observation battalion that was driving down the same road. So he was right there during the supposed Malmedy massacre and told a completely different story than what has been portrayed, you know, especially the movie The Battle of the Bulge from back in the 70s. And basically, these American soldiers that were taken prisoner were so ill-behaved for the most part, they were still trying to escape and get away, because you had, you know, like, a, you know, 80, 90 or 100 soldiers that were only facing three or four initial German soldiers. And so they were, and things were very confused. Some of the soldiers were reined in. They were put in formation, while other soldiers were trying to hide behind a building. They were trying to escape through woods and ditches. And all that it took was for one German soldier to see this. And with being young, maybe combat inexperienced, fired a shot. And in turn, other fresh German units had arrived on scene, and they witnessed a German soldier firing. And they just assume, there's still fighting going on here. And so they opened fire. But unfortunately, they opened fire on anybody. And so they end up hitting the one group of soldiers who was told to stand fast and not move. They ended up being shot down. I mean, certainly not a war crime. It was, in my way of thinking, and the way that these SS officers viewed it as well, it was one of those fog of war type situations that was actually brought on by the American soldiers themselves by refusing to stand fast and surrender. One that I even interviewed said that an American soldier had fired shots. And that's why Hans Siptrot, in his interview, he goes into this where he was down in the tank and his loader, I think, is the one that popped up out of the hatch and started shooting with a pistol. Hans didn't hear the gunshot from the Americans, but another witness said an American soldier had fired on the Germans. That's what caused Hans's loader, or radio, it was either a loader or a radio operator, to open fire, and it's what started the whole, the whole cascade of, the Germans opening fire on this group. But again and again, like Orador Sorglane is another one. I've interviewed numerous Das Reich veterans and a couple of the officers that were there. It's nothing like what we are told. Conventional history says that the Germans were so angry and upset that they had to go fight in Normandy, that they just went into an innocent French village and just massacred everybody just because they hated the French. Again, truth is, it's not the truth. The truth was that this town held a lot of illegal ammunition. German soldiers had been murdered by the resistance, and a lot of this town was already marked with, they wore little armbands to denote them as freedom fighters, as the Allies had asked them to do. And when the Germans came in, they were already in a bad mood. They put people in the church. They executed a couple of people that had been pointed out as responsible for the murder of young German soldiers that had been captured. And as they started burning the homes of the ones that they had found illegal munitions, more stuff had caught on fire. Matter of fact, one home exploded, killing a German soldier and wounding another one so bad he had to have his leg amputated. And this just set off a whole cataclysm that then something happened in the church where one of the eyewitnesses surmises that someone in the church, when they started seeing the homes go up, went and they tried to retrieve explosives or weapons or something, and they set off the fire. But the bottom line is the Germans did not intentionally set the church on fire and kill 600 people or however were in there.
So they had ammunition in there. So the partisans had ammunition in there. The so-called French resistance, who weren't French, and they were kind of communists from all over Europe, and they were terrorists. Absolutely. Basically. They weren't armed. They weren't in uniform. They were terrorists, and yet they're lionized. Exactly. Today.
They sure were.
Well, so that's talking to these SS generals, and you were saying there that they were basically getting money together and funds together for people that had fought for the Wehrmacht and fought for the Germans, because at the end of the war, I mean, I guess they would have had a lot of injuries, and they would have been expecting some kind of compensation. And I believe they weren't given any, or they weren't given pensions. They were just left to rot, weren't they?
And as sinister as Silent Help is made out to be, it really is not sinister at all. They did work a little bit, from what I understand, with helping to get some of the younger soldiers and such sent to South America, where Germans had established safe havens. But for the most part, Silent Help was there to help the soldier that lost an arm, lost a leg, the German government, because with Nuremberg, the tribunals declaring the Waffen-SS as a criminal organization, the German government did not offer any type of compensation to a Waffen-SS veteran. They had to fight tooth and nail, even to get welfare or something. And so that's what Silent Help was designed to do. It took up collections, which actually came in from all over the world, because there was a lot of people that understood that Germany was not this evil nation that the Allies made out, you know, made it out to be. And my aunt told me that she remembers they got donations a lot from governments too in the Middle East and South America, here in the United States, Canada, people, the churches all over Europe helped give, even though now, you know, the Catholic Church completely has turned their back and, you know, they make it sound like the National Socialists picked on them. But back then, the Catholic Church was actually very big on trying to give aid to the veterans, at least for a short time, until the Allies started, or the occupation forces started to crack down on this. But yeah, that was the whole point of Silent Help, was to help soldiers that basically needed it. They couldn't get jobs. They had no money. A lot of them that had family, you know, the wife had to go out and work. Even the children had to go out and, you know, get odd jobs, just, you know, give them a roof over their head.
And you think, you know, people with limbs missing and they've been really severely injured, and they were injured trying to prevent the communists from making their way into Western Europe. I mean, the Waffen-SS was made up of legions from all over Europe that were just fighting on the Eastern Front against the Bolsheviks. And then to think that you're not going to get any welfare or any pension when you come back. I mean, that's a real horrific state of affairs for these brave young men that tried to save Europe, really. Well, I also noticed there's a lot of women in your interviews here. You interviewed Ida Goering, Irene Rosenberg, as we said, Gudrun Himmler, all these daughters of these famous people, Leni Riefenstahl as well. I mean, she's a really famous character. What was it like interviewing Leni Riefenstahl?
She was, you know, very interesting to meet, because when she had a hand actually in Silent Help. I know she would never have wanted that made known, but that's one of the reasons I was kind of given a easy interview with her. And I caught her on a very good day, I think, because she just, if you read the interview, she just lays it out. In which later on, I read her, you know, memoirs, and I'm assuming it's, you know, her memoirs take kind of a different tone, more of a pensive tone. But when I knew her, or, you know, got to talk to her, she, as you can tell, very very loyal to the Führer. One of the things that she speaks about, she was asked to help early on with the, you know, the propaganda effort. And she was in Poland, and she ended up witnessing German soldiers executing some terrorists. She didn't know the full story then, but, you know, the story that's published today is that she was so shocked and angered and upset that, you know, she demanded to speak with Hitler, and she became disillusioned with National Socialism because its soldiers were out killing innocent people. But, you know, then she came to find out what she actually saw was Polish civilians had been caught who had murdered Germans. And so because of that, they were tried and then they were taken out and executed. She just happened to see that, which I know it wouldn't, and especially for a young woman, wouldn't have been very pleasant to, you know, witness something like that. But, you know, the truth is far different than the picture painted today. You know, she was still very, very loyal to National Socialism. She understood that it was a great system to live under. You know, she was very sad that, you know, she had to live through the war and to see its demise and all that. But I understand too, from their point of view, you know, they had to rebrand themselves and make money after the war. And so I think she did the things that she had to do, and she was rubbing elbows with a lot of Jewish, you know, filmmakers, I think, you know, from the 60s and the 70s. So I'm sure she had to kind of change her tune a little bit with that. But when I met her, she, I felt like she really opened up. It was, she was a pleasure to talk to.
What about Ida Goering? I mean, how old would she have been during the war, and what were her memories of it like, and of her father? Does she remember much of her father?
She really didn't. With her, she was pretty young during all of this, or during the war, and so it just, like she says in the interview, everything that she remembered was pretty much later on in the war, because she was born in 1938, so she was young even at the very tail end of it. And a lot of what she, I think, kind of caught on to was what her mother had taught her after it was over. But she still had great memories of her father, and just like Gudrun, she did what she could to fight to portray her father in a different light than what he's cast in. Because the Allies, of course, they make Reichsmarshal Goering out to be just a big fat joke, a loser that never should have been in charge of anything, who ended up looting, half the art out of Europe just to quench his thirst for quench his thirst for having more money. And in her words, he was nothing like that at all. And actually, the reason that a lot of art was removed from a lot of important sites was to save it from the Allies, because they knew that not only were the Allies bombing out of France, one of the things a lot of historians don't either know or don't pay attention to is the Americans and the British bombed all over Europe. I mean, they bombed. France was hit very hard. Switzerland, actually, we even the American Air Force even got into a shooting war with Switzerland that most people don't know about. But Denmark
neutral,
was bombed.
So it was neutral.
Italy was.
Switzerland's always neutral, isn't it?
They were, but what was happening is that American bombers were crossing over Swiss airspace to go attack Germany, and the Swiss would send up their BF-109 fighters to try to intercept them, and the Americans would open fire on them. And so the Swiss would return fire, and they actually brought down some B-17s and B-24s, but in turn, America then turned around and bombed Switzerland, killing a number of their citizens. So it almost turned into a shooting war. America, I think, pulled back a little bit, and they ended up paying Switzerland millions and millions of dollars after the war to, make up for it. But it's an interesting side note. But, places all over Europe were bombed pretty heavy, and the Germans, wanted to save the culture of Europe, because that was one of the main embodiments, I feel, of National Socialism, that we are one race, one people, of course, divided up into different tribes, but we all share a common bond and a common interest, and they wanted to save our heritage. So yes, they removed a lot of artwork from galleries, museums, castles, and they put them in caves for safekeeping. And I know Goering did take some of them into his protective custody on his train in Holmes. But these, I think, under the circumstances, it's something you can certainly understand on why they would do this. And it wasn't to loot and steal. These were all marked with where they came from, the contact people, who to give them back to. And it just so happened the Allies, when they came in and stole half of them and looted them. I knew a collector here in the United States where he was telling me stories where they found the Kaiser's throne in the home of a general in Texas. They found works of art from Durer and, the masters in veterans' homes that, they tried later on to sell them and things like that. I mean, it's quite interesting that the real looters were the Allies.
There's so much projection that's going on here, from the mistreatment of the people in the camps. I mean, a lot of them died due to starvation, due to the Allied bombing of all the supply lines, to then talking about the looting of art treasures, when in actual fact they were being taken into protective custody to prevent them from from being bombed. We also interviewed Irene Rosenberg, and I think that her father has really been mischaracterized as wanting to destroy Christianity, and I've shown that really he was against the church and clericalism, which is really seemed to be what the National Socialists were against, was clericalism. They weren't against Christianity, they were against clericalism. And what was it like interviewing her, and what was her memories of her father like? Was she very young when he was alive again, or was she a bit older?
Yeah, she was very young too, but you know, I was with her, I got a good sense, and something too, I think you and me had kind of talked about this too. One of the things that the SS, National Socialism, and especially Rosenberg are accused of, and that is being anti-Christian, being anti-church, anti-Christ. Right after the war, a lot of, Allied propaganda went around, and even during the war, that tried to insinuate or present National Socialism as the Antichrist, on Earth. But that's, again, not really true. From talking to Irene and Gudrun, General Carl Wolf, and a lot of these people that had, the spiritual knowledge, I would call it, of National Socialism and the SS, they had the belief that I think is probably more in tune with what's called Christian identity, if that's still, a thing today. But they believed that the Christian church in Europe had been corrupted by the Eastern Jews that came in hundreds of years earlier. They believed that the Jewish people had absorbed or had taken over the true identity of the Israelites, or the people of the Bible. I think, one of the things Gudrun, one of the many evenings that I had spent speaking with her, was sharing some thoughts about what her father thought about this. Because her father was a very idealistic person. He liked to explore every notion that was out there. He would get into lively debates. When I interviewed Reinhard Heydrich's wife, Lena, and one of the things that was interesting is she had told me that her husband would get annoyed at Himmler. Sometimes they would go to dinner together, and Himmler was always advocating these new ideas that, the Annenerbe had brought forth or something, and they would kind of annoy Reinhard, because he was a very traditional Christian and things like that. But with the SS, they really believed that the church of that time and of today was the enemy of the European people, because the church had been taken over by Jewish idea or ideals. Just you think of what the church believes today. The church, in nearly all denominations, believe that we are all coming from Adam and Eve, that the Jewish people were called by God to be his chosen race, and that the Jewish people are special above all other people on the earth because they hold a distinct connection to God, where all of the other, quote, Gentiles are just kind of along for the ride, so to speak. And I think a lot of SS thought, they rejected that. Rosenberg did it a little harshly. I mean, he really criticized this whole notion of there being, Jewish God and everything. But I think the more moderates believe, God is absolutely, real. He has existed for our people, but it's our people that the Bible was written to, that it was written for, and it was written about. No one else, no other race on earth. I think they have some merit with that too. As ridiculous as some people think that theory is, I think they have they were onto something. I think they just never were able to bring it to fruition, but they did create the German Christians, and the German Christian movement completely rejected all of this interdenominational fighting between Catholics and Protestants. You know, they basically believed we are one race, we are one people, we have one God, we have always been, you know, with this one God from the inception of the creation of Adam and Eve, you know, till modern times. So that's a whole nother story in itself.
But were any of the people that you interviewed, were they pagans at all? Were they talking about paganism? Because they do all seem to be Christian or subscribing to the Christian beliefs from the ones that I've seen. Because we do, you know, there are a lot of people today that think National Socialism was all about paganism. It was going to get rid of Christianity and replace it with paganism. And yet, from the interviews that I've seen that you've done, they all seem to be Christian, or saying that my father was Christian and he wasn't a pagan. He wasn't an antichrist. So did you come across any pagans among your interviews?
Well, it's kind of hard to explain. Anybody who has visited Germany and has taken an interest in some of the old, you know, maybe going into some of the old German cathedrals or churches, you will notice that there's a lot of pagan symbolism in those places of worship. You'll see runes, you'll see other artifacts that are hearkening back to Germany's past. From my understanding, and just speaking to some of these people, when Himmler created the SS and the idea of, you know, this new era, you know, for Germany, it was to bring the past into the present to give a better future. And one of the ways that they did this was acknowledging their past. Germans have always been very deeply rooted to where they came from. And, you know, they did come from at the time that, you know, say, for example, when the disciples went up into Europe, Europe was all mostly just pagan tribes. You know, they had, you know, my thinking is as they made their way up through the Caucasus Mountains and, you know, had started to form, you know, the 12 main tribes of Europe, they lost their way. They became pagan. And when the Christians came, you know, of course, we know the Christians forcibly at times converted some of the, especially the northern tribes, and turned them pagan. Well, what Himmler was doing is, since that era of our history was so noble, with a lot of good, you know, writings, the Eddas and all that, he wanted to maintain that, bring that to a point where it's a point of pride. That's why a lot of the SS, their symbolism was all of the Nordic and Germanic symbols. But he also married that with the fact that a lot of SS men were Christian. You know, they were born Christian, baptized Christian. And so his way was to allow you to have your, you know, your pagan and Christian beliefs. And just, I think if I'm kind of explaining it correctly, is they would be joined together and not be in conflict with one another. So yes, you will see some SS men were indeed pagan. They hearken back to, you know, their Viking ancestors, and they wanted nothing to do with this Jewish, you know, God. You know, they wanted to fall back on what their ancestors lived by. But at the same time, they understood there was a greater creator who we owe our existence to. And I think National Socialism and this idea was like a work in progress, if that, you know, makes any sense. I don't know if they necessarily had ironed out all of the kinks, because you had different schools of thought. You know, you had the Thule society, which was very pro-pagan. You know, they wanted nothing but a return to the pagan past. You know, you had people that didn't want anything to do with religion whatsoever, whether it was pagan or Christian. And then you had the traditional Christians that were trying to get away from this whole idea, where I think they understood, you know, these people that call themselves Jews are not a good people. They are a people that are, you know, basically all of the evil comes out of their, you're out of their loins, out of their genetics. And so they didn't want anything to do with these people. They certainly didn't want to have anything to do with the religion of these people. But at the same time, I think they started to disassociate that God's not part of these people. So how can we incorporate God into, this new, belief we have.
Yeah, I don't think they really had time to develop it because, they had the war going on for 5 years, and they did get some way with trying to unite the church, and some of the more extreme pagan types were put in camps. But I think it gets mischaracterized there. I agree with you there with what you were saying about the research into the past. And if you're going to try and idealize the past and make what we look back to the noble times of the fighting and the chivalry and the warriors, then you're going to be using a lot of pagan imagery. But it doesn't mean that you're sacrificing goats in the forest to Odin. It just means that you're honoring the past in a continuous wave through to the present. So the same way you would get church bells that were being created and churches that were being renovated, they would also be honoring the feast days of the past, and like a synthesis between the two, because it was all European, whether they were pagan or whether they were Christian, they were European, they were Germanic. So it would be a Germanic type of Christianity and a Germanic type of paganism. In fact, it was it was that Germanic side of it that was more important than anything else. I think that gets lost today with the Hollywood presentation of paganism and also the presenting of paganism as some kind of alternative New Age paganism, because you can't go back to the past. I mean, it's a dead religion. The only real holdover from that is Santa Claus as Odin. And that's the only continuous bit that goes back to then is things like that. The idea of little sacrifices and blots in the woods and all this. I mean, that all comes from the New Age. It was all created over the last in the last 200 years. I just looking through here as well. You had an interview with Axis Sally as well, and she must have been one of the few Americans that you interviewed. What was she like?
Yeah, she was really interesting, very quiet. I think she was very humbled because she worked in a convent, in my hometown. And it just so happened that one of her friends lived close to us. And how I met her was interesting. I was running around our neighborhood playing war with all the neighborhood kids, and I'm wearing a German helmet. And I happened to run, we certainly, being young, didn't respect people's yards. And I was running through her friend's yard, and Mildred was out on the porch, and she sees me running through with a German helmet, and she yells at me. She was like, "Youngster, hey, come here." And I stopped. I was like, "Oh, I'm in trouble." And so I went back up the hill, or back up the yard to her. And she goes, what are you wearing?" And I said, I'm wearing a German helmet. And she, "Why are you wearing that?" I said, "Oh, my grandfather, had brought it back, and I'm playing war." And I don't really even remember how old I was, but I never forget. She says, "Well, do you realize that the men that wore that helmet, they were fighting to save the world from the Jews?" And that just put the hook in me. At first I was like, "What is she talking about?" But, she went and got me a popsicle from her friend's freezer, and then started talking to me. And then I wanted, just like the German, couple that lived next door to us, I tried to see her as often as I could, which wasn't very often. She did meet with me. And then later on, I was able to kind of jot down some questions and do the interview with her.
Yeah, so and you're collecting all this together, then, you're saying, into a book. When do you think that will be released then? Any idea?
Well, there's so many interviews that right now it's probably going to be a 3-volume work. We are about done with volume 1, which is going to deal solely with Waffen-SS officers or men who won high awards. Like, I've met a lot of Knight's Cross holders, German Cross holders, honor roll holders. So that's what this volume is going to do. I forget how many I even have in there. I think probably maybe 80 interviews of Waffen-SS men. And it runs the gamut. They talk about why They volunteered to serve in the SS. They talk about their enemies, you know, what it was like fighting the Russian soldier, the American soldier. And of course, with just about every one of these guys, I asked them, you know, what is your opinion of the charges against the Waffen-SS of being a criminal organization? And so they, you know, kind of they explain, you know, their thoughts on war crimes and, you know, what they witnessed, which most of the time it was the crimes committed against them, not them committing crimes against someone else.
Did you manage to get any pictures taken with them when you were interviewing them? You were saying that they were really keen on the photography at the beginning. Did you get nice pictures of them?
You know, one of the things, if I could go back and redo this, I would make sure that, because I wrote down these interviews in Scribble, so I could go back to reread them, and I would have recorded them, and I also would have gotten my picture taken with every one of the people I met, but I did not. Some of them did give me pictures. Some of them, you know, they autographed them or wrote a dedication for me. I do have those, but yeah, sadly, I do not have any photos of me actually with the veterans. It's one of those things, in hindsight, I would have did differently.
That would be probably be good to include some of those pictures in the book. We're just coming up to the end of the show now, so I'll say thank you very much for coming on today. I'm sure listeners will have really enjoyed that. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.